This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 94-year-old Henry Len Oshner of California City, California, where he and his wife of 70 years, Violet, settled after retiring from Hughes Aircraft, where they both worked on missile guidance systems. Len's going to take us back now to the early morning hours of June 6, 1944. With other 101st Airborne paratroopers, he was in a C-47 that flew over the English Channel, preparing to drop into the deep, dark night over France.
And the jumpmaster says, "Okay, we can have one more cigarette, and that's it." He goes ahead and light up, so everybody's lighting up their cigarettes. And this guy next to me over here on my right, he takes out his pack, puts a cigarette in his mouth. This guy over here had already lit mine and his, and he held his lighter over to my buddy over here. He said, "Light." The man says, "No, I never light. I never have three cigarettes on a match." And he said, "Oh, okay." So he put it away. And the guy across the, had just lit up his lighter. So he went over there and got a light. While he got up, went over there, a shell came up right where he had been sitting. And it was right next to me, you know. Mm-hmm. About like here, there was a hole. About that big around.
Bigger than a quarter, like a half-dollar size hole within a foot of you.
Yeah.
And
so he looked at that and he said, "Well, I told you, no three cigarettes on a match." He said, "It's bad luck."
Well, and you can laugh about it now, but I just want everybody to understand this situation. This is the middle of the night. I mean, these are the early hours of the morning.
Real early, you know. It's still dark.
Still dark. And you are flying over France, German-held territory in France. You're going inland. As those troops are getting ready to hit the beaches, you're going a lot further. And you're going to jump out of that airplane and try to figure out where in the world you are and fight your way out of it.
I heard, I don't know how true it is, I heard that the pilots were flying any direction they could to see if they could miss all this flak that was coming up from the Germans.
Because nobody really ended up where they were supposed to be.
Very few did.
Yeah.
Well, I landed, a mile maybe, I don't know, someplace in there from St. Mary Eglise. Mm-hmm. We were supposed to drop around Carrington, which is maybe about 30 miles that way.
Right.
And we just, me and a bunch of us on our ship and about two or three other ships landed just about in the same area. Well, we all gathered in together. And we had 82nd Airborne with us. They had jumped and got jumped in the same place, you know. And they were supposed to be dropped somewhere else, too.
Uh-huh.
But on account of the pilots not knowing where they were, they just gave the green light and said, "Go."
Well, and what did that feel like? I mean, you're 21 years old. You never made a combat jump before.
No.
You probably don't even know these guys very well that you're jumping with, right?
No, you don't.
And you don't know what's waiting for you down below.
No.
So what was that like, floating down in that parachute from that C-47 under...
You're just hoping that you don't get killed on the way down.
Uh-huh.
Because some of them did.
Yeah.
The Germans were shooting at us from with their rifles, you know.
So you mentioned once you touched down and you see all these other guys that you guys all kind of huddled up. How did that unfold? Was there somebody that took charge that tried to help you know what to do?
There was a captain and a lieutenant, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of officers, and we all got together. He got us together, and he says, "We're a little ways from Carrington, which we have to get to." So he says, "We'll have to fight our way through." And St. Mary Eglise, we had to fight almost to get through it to go to Carrington. So we just about had to take St. Mary Eglise.
And how did that work? How did you experience that?
Well, I was next to a guy. He was pointing his gun at this German, but the German shot first, and he killed this kid next to me, and I got it in my head. You better be faster than that German, because if you don't, you're dead.
Uh-huh.
So from then on, I was a little faster.
Yeah.
And that's how I survived. I figured, well, either you kill him or he kills you. You don't want to die, so you have to kill him.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned St. Mary Eglise, and that, of course, is quite the tourist destination now. You were just there for the 70th anniversary a couple of years ago, and and you know how popular a spot that is. That was a key moment in this breakout. And the thing that everybody always talks about there is the parachute that's still hanging on the steeple of the church there.
The funny thing about that, John Steele was his name. And when he landed on this side, there's no street. because it was facing the street is here and the church was right here next to it, going lengthwise the same way as the street.
And did you see the parachute hanging there in 1944?
Yeah.
You saw him up there.
Wait a minute now. Anyhow, he landed and he slid on it on this one side of the church.
Uh-huh.
He's down about 10, 15 feet from the peak of the roof. And we saw him up there. Didn't think nothing about it. We kept fighting. We got to get him off of there, you know. But we couldn't get near him. But the funny part of it was they didn't, the street, the people in France said, this is the wrong side of the church. Put him on the other side where the street is so that people can see him up there. Yeah, that's what they did. They moved the parachute and him all across the other side of the church.
And for people who don't know the rest of the story, he did survive. The Germans may have thought he was up there.
Well, the story goes, he was up there and he's hanging there. He's just over the edge of the roof. And he's wanting to get away from this parachute hanging there. So he took out his jump knife and he's cutting out this harness because it jammed or something. And he couldn't get it loose.
Mm-hmm.
And he's sawing away at it. And the knife slipped out of his hand and fell to the ground. Well, there was a German right down there, and knife just went right in front of him, landed on the ground, and the German looked down at the knife, looked up, and he saw John. Pow! He shot John in the foot, but he only fired the one shot. So anyhow, the Germans eventually got John down. They got him down some way, I don't know, and they took him prisoner. Well, he got rescued, got him away from the Germans again.
Mm-hmm.
So then he came with us.
Yeah, it's quite the story. It's quite the amazing story. And what you're pointing out for the listeners is that if they go and visit today, while there is a parachute hanging there in tribute to John Steele, it's not hanging the way it was on June 6, 1944.
In the beginning.
Right. And that has been referred to famously as the longest day. How long of a day was that for you?
I really didn't pay any attention. Just a day.
No big deal.
No.
Even though you've never been in combat before.
No.
And this is the most legendary day of combat in world history.
It just didn't bother me that it was supposed to be the longest day.
Mm-hmm.
It just that it was a day.
And it had started for you at, what, 3, 4 in the morning, something like that?
Oh, about 4 or 5. After we landed and everything, we got together. It started getting very slightly starting to turn morning.
Mm-hmm. And at what point do you think you were finally able to rest?
Well, I don't really know. I never thought about it. We didn't rest all that day that I know of.
Were you scared?
No. For some reason, I was not scared. It's just that I wasn't going to let that German kill me.
Mm-hmm.
Or any German. And at that time, while we was going from St. Mary Glees to go to Carrington, we would have conflicts with the Germans. And they had wood bullets.
Wood bullets?
Wooden bullets. Did you ever hear about that one?
I've heard some, yeah. Tell
us. There were two colors. One was some red, some green. And I think that they were on a training mission. The one side had red, the other side had green. Maybe that's the way it was, unless they got mixed up. But there was two, and they were hollow. And some of the guys got hit with them, and they kind of shattered right in your skin, you know. And I had 4 or 5 of each one. But I don't know, they disappeared someplace along the line.
Oh, you carried some for a long time?
Yeah.
A little souvenir?
Yeah, it was a souvenir.
Sure.
But I lost them someplace, I don't know.
All right, so you're making it sound like this is no big deal, but there's a reason that your company has been so celebrated. What is it that you take pride in being part of Easy Company, this band of brothers?
Just being a paratrooper for the 101st. That I liked.
What can you tell me about the other guys you served with? What were they made out of?
Oh, there was a whole bunch of Texans, and I was stationed with them.
Mm-hmm.
After a while, you get to talking just like them.
Got a little drawl going?
Yeah. That was funny. People used to ask me, you from Texas? I said, no, I'm from Montana. They couldn't believe it.
And what about the days and weeks that followed D-Day? Because that's what everybody talks about, but I'm sure you had a lot more to survive and some other close calls.
Well, we fought. A bunch of little towns between St. Mary Glees and Carrington.
Mm-hmm.
We had quite a battle. We lost quite a few guys.
How did you handle that?
Well, you just look at them and say, I'm sorry. I just hope I'm not the next one.
Mm-hmm.
But you just kept going.
And you told us that you weren't scared. You said you didn't know why.
Yeah.
Did you think, and there's no right answer except your answer to this. I've heard a lot of different takes on it. Did you ever feel that somebody was protecting you?
No, never thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
I was worried that maybe I wasn't going to make it, that's all.
What are some of the moments that you look back on now and you say, yeah, that could have been me. That was way too close.
Yeah, there's some of the times that I could have been.
Can you give us some examples of those?
No.
That come to mind?
I don't like to talk about that. You don't like having to shoot somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when some of them, the Wehrmacht, they're playing soldiers. They didn't want to fight.
Mm.
But they were pushed behind them. Mm-hmm. They had SS and everybody else and big-time officer and everything else telling them either you do or we do you.
Right.
That's what I understood from some of them, the prisoners we took.
Yeah, and so you actually interacted with them and got a feel for what was happening from the other side.
Yeah, a little bit. Not much, but they didn't want to talk about it either.
What was the hardest thing for you to deal with or get used to?
Fighting, having to protect yourself.
Was there anything that you found, maybe you stumbled across or maybe you developed that helped you get through day to day under those kind of circumstances?
You're very watchful. You look all around to make sure that you're going in the right direction and that nobody's pointing a gun at you.
Mm-hmm. And I don't want to move on from D-Day too quickly. I'm sure you've talked to a lot of people about it over the years and you've read and seen and heard a lot about it. But at the time, did you have any sense of whether this was a successful mission or a failure?
We had no idea because we didn't have that communication. We had, I think, maybe a radio, somebody had one maybe. But we really didn't know what was going on, except that we knew we had to get to Carrington and meet up with everybody else.
And when you look back on that now, and like I said, you were just there 2 years ago back at Normandy for the 70th anniversary. What strikes you now about that day and its significance? Is there an aspect of D-Day, that Normandy invasion, that impresses you or is eye-opening for you?
I never thought about it. When we got to Carrington, we didn't. See, Carrington's a little bit inland. Not much, but a little bit. We didn't know what was going on the beaches or nothing like that. We didn't know anything about that.
Mm-hmm.
We got to Carrington, and then we started fighting east.
But you know about it now. You know what happened.
Yeah, they didn't. A bunch of them didn't make it. But that's as far as I know about that. I wasn't scared about it.
Does it give you some pride or satisfaction to have been a part of what happened that day?
Yes, I am. I'm proud I was with the 101st and able to fight with them.
And what was it like to go back there 70 years later? What were the things that you saw or did that stand out in your memory?
Well, I saw potholes that you could drive a Jeep in and you walk back 30 feet and you couldn't see it. The holes were that big and someone told me that there was ships out to sea. It was out there a ways that they could fire their cannon and hit these things that the Germans always had, pillboxes.
All the pillboxes. So these are shells from the American battleships, Texas that's right offshore that left these craters that are still there.
Some of them craters was just about from here to that wall,
mm-hmm.
about 12, 14 feet across.
So that was eye-opening for you.
Yeah. They were close. They were like close to the pillbox, just one pillbox. And I didn't go in at a pillbox or nothing. I just looked at it, looked at the holes. There was about three or four big potholes where our cannon made them trying to get to that.
Yeah, those craters will continue to help tell the D-Day story for years and years to come. But there aren't too many of you men who jumped behind enemy lines that day still with us, and only a few of you from the famous Band of Brothers. So when you were back there for the 70th anniversary of D-Day, I have to imagine you were quite the celebrity. Can you tell me a little bit about that adventure you had and the way they treated you over there?
That was good.
Tell me about it. What happened?
Well, we went into St. Mary Glace in a bus from the ship. I got on the ship as a Mara Journey, as a cruise ship. We got on it in Portugal, and it came around up there, followed the coast around into France, Germany, and England, and places like that. When we got to some port there in France, we got onto this bus, and we headed for St. Mary Glace. Well, St. Mary Glace just didn't look the same no more. There must have been 5,000, 10,000, 15,000 more homes and everything built around it. And you was amazed at how big it got. to people. It was a tourist town. And this one street must have had 3,000 people on it, and that's the way we had to go. Try to get through that 3,000 people to get to the museum. When we got in there, this guy had a Jeep. And on a bumper, you know, we always had our company painted on a bumper. Well, this one said 506 Parachute Infantry Regiment on it.
This Jeep that just happens to be driving through the streets of St. Mary-Glise 70 years later.
Yeah. So we're talking to him, and he says, could I have you autograph something for me? I said, yeah. He says, and he handed me this Thompson submachine gun. So I signed it, you know. I put 506 on it and everything.
Yeah.
My company and everything on it. Then some guy walks up with another one, and I had to sign that one. Well, this guy that owned the Jeep says, autograph my hood. So I autographed the hood.
Uh-huh.
And we couldn't get through. So this guy says, I'll get you through. Hop on my Jeep. And it was the same kind of Jeep with 506 on the bumper. And I autographed it. And as I sat in the dummy seat, you know, the captain of this cruise ship was with us. So he jumped up behind me. I got a picture of it up there.
Mm-hmm. I see the crowd around you.
Yeah. Well, right directly behind me, that's our captain of the ship. He got us through. And somebody, there was about two or three guys, and we're trying to move. And these guys are standing there, and they said, no, you don't go through it till you sign this gun. And so they come on the bus, and I signed it, and then they moved to one side. We got a little ways, and it was taking too long. And the little gal that does the commentator on the bus, you know, this point is such and such. This point there, this is one of our attractions over here. That's an attraction over there. Somebody says, well, we have to get back to the ship. Just about that time, a police car is in front of us. So she run out, and she's talking to him. And first thing you know, she's back in the bus, and the police got us right in front of us.
Mm-hmm.
Got the siren going and everything, and they got us to the freeway. No problem. People just spread out and let us through.
You received quite the royal treatment over there.
Uh-huh. Shaking hands, taking pictures, getting kissed on the cheek and everything imaginable. Oh, about 200-300 times, you know, one way or another.
It's break time again, but don't forget to find photos of Mr. Ochsner at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. When we come back, this surviving member of the Band of Brothers remembers the Battle of the Bulge and the unthinkable scene he witnessed at a concentration camp. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.